Good morning, Mal. How are you?
Morning.
Thank you.
I'm fine.
Well, I hear you probably had quite a long night last night from the sound of it. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, I shall try and stay awake.
Thank you. Was it procedural matters or other business?
No, not particularly. I don't know. Don't know
Okay.
what happened. Just ended up doing stuff and had quite a late night.
It was quite a sticky, balmy night last night, wasn't it? Sort of a late summer thing. Anyway. I wonder if we could start with the resurgence of Eddie Lister, our old friend from Wandsworth, who worked for Boris for a bit as chief of staff, I think, and his review of Tory strategies in London in the light of Susan Hall's candidacy. A controversial candidate, he's not apparently bothered by that, but by the sort of political weather around within which candidates have been selected lately. Perhaps Sean Bailey's resonating here as well. I see Leone's joining us. You may have some forthright views about that. What do you make of what Lister's doing and why he's been asked to do it?
Well, the Tories basically abandoned London in the particularly in the 2017 election, the Theresa May one. Their sort of whole approach seemed to be that they would follow a very sort of pro-Brexit line, and London isn't England, or London isn't the United Kingdom. It's not really like the rest of the place, and the aim was to kind of sacrifice London for what became, in the 2019 election, the Red Wall. And they were sort of half successful. They abandoned London, all right. So they lost Battersea, which was held by a very moderate Jane Ellison, a very moderate One Nation sensible Tory. They lost Richmond, sorry, Twickenham, which they held at that stage. Vince
When
Cable
Vince
won
Cable came in,
Twickenham,
yeah.
and they sort of it was followed by the time we came to last year's council elections. There were Tories, who had run a whole string of councils very, very recently, like Richmond and Redbridge and Kingston and a number of such councils, where the Tories were down to single figures in council seats, and they were really pushed back to, Kensington and Chelsea will probably be Conservative forever by its nature, but the Tories were really pushed back into their sort of out of London strongholds like Hillingdon and Havering and Bromley and Bexley and were an endangered species in inner London, really. And that was really a policy stance that was turning their back on the tradition of the One Nation tradition of Tories, progressive conservatism, I guess you might call it, which was characterised. So, unsurprisingly, the conservative machine has pretty much disappeared in inner London. There's ones with the Tories are still, to be fair to them, I think they're making quite a good fist of opposition, and they remain very active. But there's plenty of other places where they're pretty much out of the picture now. Now, of course, as was shown in 2019, the Tories don't need London in order to win a big majority nationally. But if they are belatedly recognising that London is part of the United Kingdom, actually a rather important part of the United Kingdom, and shouldn't just be, sacrificed on the altar of a rather silly right wing set of attitudes more than policies. The policies don't work; it's the attitudes that are the problem. Then, looking at what's going on in London makes sense. But I think it's a bit, personally, I think it's a bit unfair to blame the London Conservative parties for the position they find themselves in when they've been so thoroughly let down by the National Party.
Leonie Graham, good morning. We started, Mal and I, talking about Eddie Lister's review of the selection of Susan Hall, not so much as a thing in itself, but in terms of how the machinery is working, because there seem to be sort of, as it were, noises of. Leonie, you were quite close, you know Susan Hall relatively well at the Assembly. What do you make of the political weather around it? Of course, preceded by the luminary that was Sean Bailey.
Lord Bailey of Jingle and Mingle to you.
Oh, yes, indeed. I do. I mean, I doff my cap.
Well, and so you should. He was bizarre seeing him introduced into the House of Lords. I can't think of anybody less deserving. Well, apart from Charlotte Owens.
Boris's old chum. Yep.
Well, some people are saying Boris's daughter. I mean, absolutely no idea whether
there could be hundreds in her wake, of course, couldn't there? But anyway,
I was going to say, should fill the House of Lords for another couple of dozen people at least, I should think. I think it would be denied that it's a review into the selection of Susan Hall. I think they're calling it a review into the selection process.
Hmm.
Obviously, Susan Hall is the person that was elected through that process. I mean, it is extremely peculiar that they ended up with a shortlist of three that contained two people who could hardly be described as frontline politicians. I mean, I think outside of political circles, who on earth had ever heard of Daniel Korski or Moz Hussein? In fact, who on earth outside of conservative political circles? And they removed Paul Scully, who's both an MP and the Minister for London, and they removed a couple of other people who, in the lead-up to the longlisting and the shortlisting exercises, had actually been receiving quite a lot of news coverage for, you know, a variety of comments and things that they were doing. So it seemed that there were sort of some very, potentially worthy candidates who were removed from the shortlist. And then once you saw that Daniel Korski was removed, I just assumed that the way the shortlist had been constructed was to make sure he won for some reason or another. But then when he was removed because of his inability to stop his wandering hand problem.
Not a bit about, isn't there? About, yeah, yes. Anyway, yeah, yeah.
WHT, wandering hand trouble.
Indeed.
Who knew? And then I just thought, well, surely they have to choose Susan just from the two that are left. But, I mean, I've got no idea how the decisions were made just to bring it down to those three in the first place. So maybe it is worthy of looking at how the decisions were made, because it does seem very... I mean, I just can't imagine that happening on the Labour side. I really can't. I mean, it's been very, strenuously fought over. The first time, there was Frank Dobson, Nick Rainsford, obviously Ken Livingstone, who the party decided they didn't want the shortlist either, and who then went on to win as an independent. So, I mean, it's all a bit of a... But they were all MPs, and they all had quite strong profiles, and there were others as well. I can't remember who else was involved. Now it's 23 years ago, dredging my memory. It does seem odd to create a shortlist of people that no one's ever heard of, apart from Susan, who I would say is very well known in conservative.
She's very vocal indeed, yes.
That is one way of describing Susan. She has very strong views. I actually quite like Susan a lot. She's incredibly hardworking. She's really hardworking. And she pushed the conservative group on the assembly. And made sure they turned up to everything, and they were always there. I mean, since she stopped being their leader in May because she was given the boot, obviously that freed up her time to chase the selection. But I mean, they failed to show up. They're just not showing up to things. Quite often, committees with gaps on them. They haven't even bothered to arrange a substitute. Almost none of them turned up to Armed Forces Day, which I would have thought, if you were going to say this would be something that Conservative Assembly members would show up to.
They'd be attempting to march, wouldn't you? Yes, yeah.
Well, no, they've done it. I think there was three of them. Well, Susan herself, Andrew Boffers chairs the Assembly, and one other turned up. So it's very strange. And they have been... They only seem to have one policy, though, and that is to be extremely rude about the Mayor, and in particular his policy on ULEZ, Oh, and just as an FYI, Malcolm, Havering isn't Conservative controlled anymore. It's
No,
a
of course,
straight,
that's right. Yes, it's
yeah,
so
it's
far away,
FYI,
isn't it? I
FYI.
mean, it's beyond the reach of the naked eye and even a periscope.
It's being run by a in conjunction independents and Labour. So the Conservatives are now the opposition in Havering, which is quite a thing. So I think they're down to Hillingdon, Bexley, Bromley. They won Harrow back, of course, in
That's right, yeah.
2022, and they won Croydon due to the elected mayor, where they won by 600 votes, the directly elected mayor, although the councillors have a majority of Labour councillors, which is quite an interesting. And I think the rest of outer London is either Labour now, or Labour and Independent, or it's a Liberal Democrat. So they've only got five councils left,
I mean, it's the
plus, of
big,
course, K and C in the middle.
the big morale-raising blue flag is that 495 votes in favour up in Uxbridge and South Ruislip. But Shane's in, I think, maybe what you were saying there, do you think, of Nadine Dorries going AWOL and being nudged towards resigning, but perhaps eyeing that 22 grand she can still net if she clings on for a bit. And then in another part of the forest, Jeremy Corbyn being quizzed at the Edinburgh Book Festival, I think, earlier this week. About the prospects of himself running as London mayor because he's been debarred from the candidature in Islington North. Graham, good morning. What do you make of the Tories of London, and are we democratically in deficit if they're not, as Leonie was pointing out there, showing up? And is this a reflection of their morale? And do we need them in their present form? Do we need them in some form, or do we need something different? As I think Rees-Mogg and Dorries themselves were mooting a little while ago.
Well, I certainly think, their time has come. It's a game of consequences. Once you start avoiding traditions and democratic constitutions,
I was
then
going to say that word's going to come up, and there it is, yes.
yes. Well, the explanation is once you start, then you're on the slippery slope. It gets worse and worse, like in Israel.
It's like they've, as somebody said, I think an insider, they've lost their mojo. It's a piece by Raphael Baer in the Guardian this week, talking about what he perceives as the death throes of the Sunak regime, and the suggestion that some of the policies, for example, the Illegal Migration Act and the Bibi Stockholm Abbey open this week, is because it's hamstrung legally. From actually being by the Supreme Court from being enacted is in effect a policy that's in fact a slogan, and that the game would seem to be upping the ante for Starmer to be accused of tax rises and the traditional tropes in sorting out the mess.
Yes, they're playing political games, which I think the public can see through.
You
And
think?
I think so. Well, this is the constant debate we have, is what people's perception is on the street. And that's exactly the kind of thing that the public pick up, is the party in its death throes, is just incapable. It's incompetent. People realize that they can't run the government, and all the policies they bring in are badly thought through, and so they don't work, and so they have to try again in a different tack, and they're just incapable of making a consistent policy plan.
Do you mean the different tack is simply the next bit of sloganizing?
Yeah,
Or is there might there be a rethink going on?
they're just running on populism and slogans. That's what populism does,
Mal, as a former Conservative in local government, what do you think? I mean, it's a broad question. What do you think of the party now? Do you think it will see better days again? Or and is it perhaps traditional that there are dog days in a parliamentary cycle? But do you look on this and weep, or what do you do?
It's difficult to no. I mean,
One thing he's always said is never underestimate the Conservative Party's ability to reinvent itself and to overcome. Yeah, it was very close to being wiped out in the 1945 landslide. It was certainly, in effect, was wiped out in the 1906 landslide when we lost to the Liberal Democrats. But it's been around for centuries and it keeps coming back. And you know, in 1997 with the Blair landslide, repeated in 2001, it would have been, you know, quite difficult to imagine the Conservatives would be back with an overall majority within 15 years of the second of those landslides. And I think there's always going to be a place for a right of centre party in politics. I think the really big question, I think, if Labour is elected, is to whether, or in this narrow terms of future political parties, will probably be whether they do look seriously at proportional representation, because it's very difficult to see that you could ever end up with a majority government of any colour, I suspect, but certainly of the Conservatives, if we did move over to a more proportional system of elections. I mean, there are pros and cons of all electoral systems. I'm not an enormous fan of the kind of broader representation that's given us the politics of Italy, let's say, over the last three or four decades, or Israel for that matter. In the absence of that, the Tories will need to reinvent themselves. I mean, they've slipped so far off to the silly right wing at the moment. And part of that, as Graham says, is it's a fig leaf for the fact that the policies that they are, you know, going on about so much are just disastrously not working. We've got the biggest yesterday report of the longest health service queues that we've ever had, I think, since health service was introduced. The picture on the illegal, I'm never quite sure if they're illegal or not, but certainly the people coming over in the small boats is way out of any sort of historical precedent whatsoever. And all the things the Tories sort of tinker about, they don't seem to have any ideas how they'd actually deal with them. And they've fallen just into a thing of saying, if we can't do anything about it, let's at least be nasty to the people who are involved and try and try that. And the picture, there was a by-election in Havering. We were, you know, just talking about Havering a moment ago, but yesterday, where the local, it was in Upminster, and the local, the several residents' parties in Havering, who are sort of broadly working together in this coalition that Leonie mentioned, but the you know, an area which was pretty much rock solid, very solid right wing conservative, not all that long ago. There's always been a residents' association thing there, but the residents got over 1,600 votes, and the Tories only got 400 odd. Now, part of that was because the Tories had had to disown their candidate for Islamophobic and COVID conspiracy theory tweets, but they disowned the candidate too late for them to be able to find another candidate. So the candidate was there without any support from the party. But even so, that margin of defeat is just astounding for an area like Havering, but not astounding in the London context. So this is, yeah, Redbridge was Tory very recently. It's now down to single figures. They're single figures in Merton, which was Conservative, never quite a Conservative majority, but was Conservative run three or four elections ago. They're down single figures in Richmond, single figures in Kingston, all these places that Enfield, they're in trouble. All of these places that have been Conservative within living memory have turned their backs on the party. So I can't see the sort of them getting anywhere with this rather sort of nasty slip into right wing rhetoric. They need to decide at some point whether they're going to recreate the party of the likes of David Gawke and Dominic Grieve and Ken Clark and, you know, fundamentally very, very decent people and actually really rather efficient people as well. At some point, they're going to need to decide, do we want to, you know, get back into that area of attracting people from a wider range in the way that Blair was just so very, very good at. because until they do, I think London in particular is going to be a closed door.
Presumably, this is the Susan Hall problem, isn't it? Leone, what do you make of this this question?
Yeah, I was going to say it's very hard to imagine that Susan Hall is the candidate who's going to be able to do that, because she's expressed some views that I think most people in London would find, and actually some Conservatives, based on what Malcolm is saying, although not so many anymore, would find really very difficult. I mean, she supported Donald Trump, lock, stock, and two smoking barrels.
He also had the wandering hands, indeed, yes, yeah.
And including to the extent that she supported the invasion of the Capitol building, which I thought was absolutely outrageous for someone in elected office to be supporting that. She retweeted some tweets and has also liked tweets by Lawrence Fox, who is clearly, I think, completely...
He was a mayoral candidate, wasn't he? And somebody joined his party, who I think is... Are they still in government now?
He's not a Conservative.
Yeah.
And he also tweeted an arrangement of the pride flags, I think it was, that were arranged so that they made a swastika, and she retweeted it and liked it. I mean, I don't think retweeting and liking swastikas and highly offensive stuff is, I mean, she's very, you know, part of the attacks, people who are woke, whatever that is supposed to mean. And of course she's right up Graham Street. I know Graham will probably join her campaign team. She's extremely strongly in favour of Brexit. So pro-Trump, pro-Brexit, anti-woke, how's that going to go down in London? Rearrange the following words into a well-known phrase or saying, cup, sick, cold. You know, I mean, seriously, I cannot see how in most parts of London she is going to do anything other than really annoy even, you know, previously Conservative voters. I mean, I think this very right-wing rump that's in Parliament now as well, because if you remember, there was a big throwing out of people like David Gawk and Dominic Grieve, and Justine Greening was another one. They all decided not to stand for the Conservatives. Yes, and apparently, Zach Goldsmith is an interesting one, because he fought a campaign against Sadiq that was overtly racist. There were
true. There was Islamophobia about, wasn't there? Yeah.
Yeah, there were direct mail letters that went out to people from the Sikh and Indian community that basically said the mayor is, well, wasn't the mayor at the time, the Labour candidate will be coming for your gold that you've stashed in hidden places in your house, and the gold bracelets that your women folk wear. I mean, it was really, really offensive stuff, which I was quite shocked that Goldsmith was involved in that sort of thing. But driving a wedge between Labour and the Hindu and Indian community has definitely worked, because Harrow was retaken by the Conservatives. And also, for anyone who didn't go to Uxbridge during the by-election, there is quite a substantial Indian and Sikh community in Uxbridge. And I think Labour did very little to... Labour didn't run a very good campaign at all, in my opinion. And I think the Conservatives just focused on the one issue. And I think, you know, could have done more to do good messaging to people from those communities, which wasn't bothered with at all by Labour. So I think, apart from winning over people from the Indian Hindu community, I think the Conservatives in London, have been losing votes hand over fist. But not just in London. Also, they've massively lost votes in a few other places, like Woking. I mean, the fact that they left the council £2 billion in debt probably didn't help either.
Yeah. I wonder if there's something here about the misreading of perhaps the lower middle class and the working class here. We have Lee Anderson and Nadine Dorris and their like sort of causing controversy wherever they stride, in the hope sort of making the 6 o'clock news. Actually, Dean Doris having gone AWOL, apparently having lost the will to do even that in, was it North Bedfordshire? The white van man of some years ago, controversial term, the idea of the red wall that was apparently so rock solid a little while ago under Boris seems to have fallen away, Graham. And was there a fundamental misreading of the, as it were, the bell curve of how these people might feel about being British and their political proclivities in the first place? Was it flawed?
Yeah, I think that's shown in the Ulez problem. Everyone gets up and drive to work, and paying £12.50 a day to go to work or do work is totally unacceptable to a large proportion of the population. And I think...
Hence they feel that one issue in Uxbridge, as you say, yeah.
Yeah, well, Keir Starmer has indicated that he's realised that it's polluter pays principle. It's not the they don't have any option as to buy the fuel. So it's the people who supply it who should be paying the fossil industries through a windfall tax of some kind, which they are partly, but not enough. And going back into the North Sea is exacerbating the whole problem. Whereas there are very good arguments for going back into the North Sea. Supply Europe against Russia.
That's true. I mean, according to a technical piece, I think, in the FT, it's in Prospect. It looks as if Norway is making most of the running to the west of Shetland at the moment, and the oil that can still be extracted is not necessarily going to be that profitable. At the same time, it has been noted by some people that Sunak's father-in-law's company, Infosys, has won quite a lot of contracts. Is it with BP? It was Shell, I think, isn't it? So that there is obviously it's no suggestion that this is a particular form of insider capitalism in action there. But the net benefit of this seems, in the view of some people, to be more sloganizing and this idea of the British Lion resurgence, which is a common trope, isn't it? I suppose of politics in general. But, does it hold water?
Well, it's relying on the misunderstanding of the energy equations. People are now experiencing global warming, and as I said, my recent exhibition that's just opened. One of the works is "The End of the World Has Begun," and that's by Greenland passing the point of no return. And we don't know how many other points on the planet have also passed the point of no return. I mean, the fires in the Arctic.
And melting, Hawaii this week. In melting a different sense, yeah. Yeah.
And this wasn't even included in the the modelling. So it looks extremely bad. And but it's still, there's a problem of people simply denying it. And it has to go to the psychological level of the passion for ignorance.
I think that's a very elegant expression of something everybody will recognize, Graham, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a phrase from Lacan.
Ah, there you have it. Well, nobly adopted.
Yeah, well, that's the state we're in, is a psychological state of terror, of global warming. It's just something that people can't face. Obviously, apart from they don't want to know about it. And there's a very interesting little clip in the Guardian Weekly. A tiny little repeat of a piece of news of a research done by the UN, which announced the best solution to global warming, more or less. And it gets absolutely no coverage at all, apart from a single article. So it's a reflection of the monopoly that still exists by the fossil industry of the energy supply of the world. And every economist knows that monopolies are bad for the economy.
Yeah. I suppose with the Guardian Weekly, they can reasonably rely on people wanting to read that, and perhaps it's fairly elusively written, but just the government space, but makes its point.
Well, hopefully it'll get some more coverage, and it'll build up a momentum for people to start taking action. And it's a technology that is very suitable for policy making. And so this is what Starmer should be doing for his green resurgence policies.
It's about a while ago, wasn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, it is the solution to global warming is for the industry to make money, the renewable industry to make money. And this is recognized by the fossil industry, is they recognize that the best way to downgrade fossil energy, renewables, is to say that they're too expensive, when there's a lot of money being made now through wind and solar. But it's being made by the Chinese and the Americans.
This is just simply not true.
Mm.
But Siemens has just $5 billion losses. Siemens in their wind division, because they've tied themselves into contracts based on the subsidies they thought they were getting. They're still getting enormous subsidies, but not enough to make money out of wind, because, as always, the problem with renewables is not particularly the cost of the blades, although those have been, I think wind blades are 40% more expensive now than they were 2 years ago. Solar is going that way, although it's protected, of course, because so much of it is made by slave labor in China, which is more resistant to global wage inflation than we're seeing in the wind industry. But the problem with all of them is that increasingly, the product they're making is of negative value, because we had a moment yesterday when in South Australia, I think, don't quote me on that, but in one of the areas where wind actually peaked at over 100% of the demand at that particular moment. Well, at that point, you've got to shut down all, if you're going to use wind, you've got to shut down all of your solar farms. You've got to somehow manage shutting down your fossil reserve in such a way that you can bring it back online, because wind dies away so very rapidly. And of course, you've also got to pay an enormous fortune to the wind industry itself to stop generating electricity, because if it doesn't, people's electronic equipment blows, and ultimately perhaps the wires melt. And the renewables are not the victim of some plot globally. They're a victim of the very simple laws of physics, which is if your monopoly doesn't come when your demand is there.
Well,
then
some would say they're yoked. It's
the economic laws of monopoly rather than physics.
Then the number of times that it's worthless also increases.
Hmm. That is the way the economy is structured, Graham, is what you're saying, isn't it? Leonie, can I ask you to come in and just think about for a moment, as you inveterately do, environmental policy? And I wonder if, with Zach Goldsmith suggesting that he might flip over to a future Starmer administration or think tank or whatever, because there's a void in terms of the Tories' former Oakleyism, whatever that might have meant at the time. But the Labour at a national level is not saying a great deal, apart from not being particularly enthused by Sadiq Khan's ULEZ policy. It is in favour of Clean Air Act, which evidently exists across several municipalities, but at district council level.
So, as you know, I wasn't able to join the podcast last week, because I'd actually gone off to talk to BBC Breakfast.
I hope that went well. I'm sure it did.
About the ULEZ scheme, and they were immediately preceded me and my small contribution with a contribution from a councillor from Surrey County Council, and Surrey, of course, was one of the five Conservative-led councils that wasted £1 million on really what was quite a frivolous court case, but was sort of making the point that we don't like ULEZ. And the reason I say it's frivolous is they had almost exactly the same set of reasons that they were trying to get the court to judicially review whether or not the mayor even had the power to expand ULEZ, whether the consultation had been flawed, whether people had been given enough information to understand and complete the consultation, all this sort of thing. And there was a judicial review of Ken Livingstone's mayoral decision to extend the original Central London congestion zone into what was called the Western Extension. And it had gone through almost exactly the same thing. There was a consultation process, and the individuals who took the trouble to respond to the consultation, there was a majority against the expansion, just as there was in the individuals, self-selected individuals who responded to the mayor's consultation about expanding ULEZ. But the polling has shown consistently across London that most Londoners are in favour of it. And of course, most people won't even pay it. And this is what the Conservatives did, a brilliant piece of scaremongering during the by-election. I was standing on people's doorsteps and they were saying, it's going to cost £12.50 a day. And then I would turn around and look at their two cars parked on the drive. And you could see that they weren't themselves going to have to pay it. And so, you know, the government has got a series of policies that are now being queried. And either we are on a drive towards from 2030, you won't be able to buy any new gas boilers and you'll have to heat your home via some other means. Everyone has been talking about heat pumps. Well, in which case, we need to start ramping up production. And we also need to train more people to install them. And we need to get a wriggle on with some of that. But we've also been saying that from 2030 onwards, you won't be able to buy any more diesel and petrol, new diesel and petrol vehicles. You will be able to buy hybrids until 2035. And those are government policies. Those aren't even Labour policies. So, I mean, I think there's a sort of disconnect. There's a, I don't know whether it's a passion for ignorance, although I do quite like that expression that Graham used and you were admiring, Andy. But I think there's a cognitive dissonance between people looking at the news over the last 2 months and seeing endless forest fires, hillsides just bursting into flames on Greek islands, various parts of Italy, various parts of Spain, various parts of Portugal, lots of them holiday destinations that are very frequently visited. And then also more recently, this last week, seeing people literally jumping into the sea in Hawaii and seeing that, I mean, if you actually look at the temperature of various parts of the Northern Hemisphere, which is where most of the land mass is currently situated on the globe, bearing in mind the plate tectonics, the land masses do move around. But if you look at the temperatures, they're just astonishing. And if you look at the reports from scientists who are measuring sea temperatures, and the sea has been very useful to us in helping to keep down the overall global temperature, not no more. And we're not just talking because of the change over to El Nino, and it's bringing warmer currents to Northern Europe. They're talking about all the coral in the Caribbean dying because the sea is so warm. And that all of these things have all been long predicted. And we do know that the main contributor to all of this is the burning of fossil fuels, either to keep ourselves warm in our houses, conduct industry, move around on the planet. So moving away from fossil fuels in heating, so that you can't buy new gas boilers from 2030, moving away from fossil fuels in mobility, you can't buy new diesel or petrol vehicles from 2030. These are all things that we need to do. We do have some huge challenges of moving over to a different way of running our lives that doesn't rely on the way things are run at the moment, not least of which there is a huge set of challenges for energy grid management that Malcolm was alluding to in his comments about the intermittent issue that relates to renewables and bringing them on and off. And, you know, are we really ramping up the possibility for battery storage much more in people's homes? Is there going to be competition, as there has been in West London already, between the demands of buildings where they've got a lot of data centres versus new homes that are trying to connect to the energy grid? And it was then found that new housing had been built and it couldn't be connected to the energy grid because all the energy in West London was going to all these data centres. Then we've also got lots of people who are constructing renewables and they're unable to get grid connections sorted out. So we've got lots of ludicrous, very badly managed, hardly managed at all, things going on. And
very
yet,
basic planning, Matt, you would have thought, isn't it?
And yet, we can see the world is on fire. So we know that we really do need to be moving at greater speed on all of these things. And the problem is, are we really up for making the change? And at the moment, I still think we've got this cognitive dissonance that says, well, we know we need to do it, but we're not going to do it. And people, I don't know what kind of world we'll be bequeathing to, you know, either the next generation or the one after that. But it seems like we just can't do the things that we've been talking since, I don't know, when was the Kyoto summit when a lot of decisions were made? When was the Rio summit when a lot of attention was paid to that? I mean, 97, you know, that's more than 25 years ago. And yet, the only one of these things that we've ever managed to successfully come away from was the Montreal summit that made the decisions about use of CFCs in fridges because we realised we were destroying the ozone layer. And, you know, we did actually manage to change, but I think that was a fairly simple change in comparison to this massive changes that we need to make.
Actually, climate change is in a different category. We've actually, as a world, been quite good at addressing these sorts of things. Bamako on waste between countries, for example, and a collection of treaties over the years have been very effective at dealing. There's a when I was at Imperial, the next door office was doing some really interesting work on pollutant life cycles and saying, as you look back through history, and you can find this with particulates in cities, you can find it with lead in petrol, you can find it over a whole massive range, the quality of water in a river like the Thames, that you get a fairly predictable cycle, that a new technique is developed which has great benefits. Then as it develops, you start to realise it's got environmental problems associated with it. You then get legislation coming along to deal with those environmental problems. That prompts innovation, either in ways of doing it the way you were doing it with less environmental effects, or finding new ways of doing it that bypass the environmental issues. And then the pollutant declines. And if you look at the level of Thames, you've got, over 100 species of fish underneath Westminster Bridge now, when the river was practically dead just after the Second World War. Lead in petrol has pretty much gone away as an issue in most countries in the world. It's just not there anymore. Of course, we found different anti-knock agents that didn't need the use of lead. Sulfur, acid rain, there've been great strides in many areas of the world. The problem with climate change is, though, that the carbon shortening problem isn't a byproduct. It isn't something that comes along with what we're trying to do for other reasons. It's actually a product. It's the main. You can't burn fossil fuels without producing carbon dioxide. That's what is the basis of the process. Beyond carbon capture and storage, which I remain hopeful but sceptical about, then it's very difficult to see how you can do this without moving away from fossil fuels. That mitigation of fossil fuels doesn't look like it's going to be enough. But then, of course, you say this, electric vehicles in the States, where they're still getting 80% of their electricity from fossil fuels in the States, or not far short of that, you're simply, by moving over to electric vehicles, you're just shifting the point at which the carbon is produced further up the upstream of the whole process. And batteries are, I think the States now has got enough battery storage to power its entire electricity demand for something like 1.5 minutes after the, you know, the amount of effort that's gone into battery through Tesla and the like in the States. Batteries are, firstly, they're very inefficient. They, you know, you don't get anything like as much energy out as you put in to store. But also they need vast amounts of minerals, and an awful lot of those are monopolized just the way, you know, by freak of geography. An awful lot of those are owned in China. China has a huge dominance over neodymium, praseodymium, and cadmium, and some of the really, really nasty elements. Now, I'd say we benefit in the West because a lot of it is done by Chinese slave labor that we don't seem to care terribly much about.
So when America disinvests from China or purports to, that's the political weather around it, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, but it does further put a massive weapon in the hands of the Chinese, where we are concerned about Chinese activities in the global economy at the moment. So it's not it's very easy to be glib about, oh, all we need is storage, but the practicalities are enormous.
It seems to me, I mean, Graham, you mentioned the UN earlier on, that little piece of the Guardian Weekly. It seems to me that a politician somewhere in the UK be moved to, or might not be moved to, stand up and talk about these environmental issues, which seem to be variously in our face. Keir Starmer isn't yet doing it, for all the fine work that Leone's done at the London level. Graham, how might somebody do this and tackle that problem of the passion for ignorance that you so clearly identified earlier on?
Well, that's the exhibition I had 2 years ago, was suggesting that politicians, because of the nature of having to be elected and be popular, aren't the best people to do it. And, you know, art and industry and scientists are far better because they have a different pace to the communications that are going on. It's very much a question of persuading people and given by imagery of coming to realize they have to act. And
but the optics are not going to come from political spin. They're going to come from art and industry.
Yeah, well, art, you know, art is extremely popular, you know, contrary to popular belief. I think it's more, there's more attendance to art galleries than there are to football matches.
So the bronze as well, I think, yes.
Yeah, and that's why, yeah, the effect of Brexit on the arts is catastrophic.
So as it were, torpedoing the availability of those optics is what you're suggesting, isn't it? Torpedoing the ability of those optics to be seen.
Well, it is all about advertising, and this is what the fossil industry has
come under a real fire. As they the Welsh separatists said to you a few years ago. Yeah.
Well, the fossil industry, there's a very good Channel 4 program on how the fossil industry has employed the same people who work for the tobacco industry in keeping people smoking. And that is the dominant factor in people's passion for ignorance.
So Kenneth Clark is a clean air zone now, isn't he, I believe? Yeah. Well, that's what I have to ask him. Yep.
There are certainly people who seem to be a blank air zone, aren't there? But I mean, just to come back to the points that I wasn't trying to be glib about.
Sorry, I wasn't accusing you of that.
I mean, I was actually saying I think this is an incredibly huge challenge, particularly the balancing the grid aspect, and I don't think we're anywhere near having solved it at all. With having people lining up to get grid connections for installations that they've created, and then being told they're going to have to wait 5 years is nonsense. I agree with you. Carbon capture and storage, everyone's now talking about it, but as far as I'm aware, it's minimal in its impact at the moment.
I think Sunak has opened a small facility in somewhere called St. Fergus, which is part of the North Sea pipeline, the digital pipeline network. I don't quite know why it's there.
Well, because what they're hoping to do, I think, is to shove it back down into the ground where they've extracted.
Right.
So that they want to sort of, you know, reverse the process of extracting oil and gas from the North Sea, and then shove carbon CO2 back down into the places where they've been extracting the oil and gas from. I think that's the principle of the carbon capture and storage.
By which Malcolm's not convinced, are you?
Well, that's the most expensive technology.
Mm.
And it's run by the fossil industry. That's why this is being applied by Sunak. It's because he's run by the fossil industry. And so the lobbyists just say, we have it under control. We're going to use this technology that is capturing the carbon and then put it under the storage and not for storage and not put it to use. Carbon capture and usage is far more economic. You can make a lot of money out of capturing carbon from the atmosphere. As Lividian is a company, sold 500 carbon capture units to the UAE, which converts methane to graphene. And graphene, the price of graphene is what, $35 a gram or something. So people, the renewable industry is going to have the same kind of colossal profits that the fossil industry have been monopolizing.
Well, that's great. So governments don't actually need to do anything. We can just, that's really encouraging, because I had thought that the problem was that it's actually much cheaper to put carbon into the atmosphere. But it's really heartening to hear that capitalism is just going to solve this. So I guess governments can stop taking actions of any description. If there's a large amount of money to be made out of removing carbon, it'll just happen, won't it?
Exactly. And that is what is happening. But it's not happening in Britain. It's happening in America and China. And they're just developing all the industries necessary.
But it doesn't matter where you remove carbon from the atmosphere, does it? We don't have to. Carbon doesn't sort of accumulate in a column over the UK that we have to deal with. If what you're saying is right and big business in China and the States are dealing with this, then problem solved. We can all go back to our normal lives. I presume that's what you're saying, that there's no need for government intervention if there's so much money to be made.
The point is we'll lose the industry.
Well, okay, and that's an industrial point for the UK. But in terms of the global climate, what I think you're saying is there's just no problem with climate change because it's extremely profitable to put it right, and that's really encouraging. We can close down all of these departments of climate change and just leave it to the market and let capitalism get on with it. That's really encouraging.
Well, it gives hope for a future Trump presidency, doesn't it? Of course, he did just that and probably would do again.
Yeah, I mean, the only problem with it is that it is complete and demonstrable nonsense, and climate change is not something that there are these simplistic solutions just ready to be deployed.
Well, you're just stating the fossil industry policy, and that is their lobby. That's how they lobby the government.
How do you explain the massive rise of hydropower globally through the first half of last century? I mean, that's not a fossil fuel, but hydropower really took on massively. Tennessee Valley Authority had the huge amounts of hydro in Scandinavia, in the west coast of the States in particular. The fossil fuel industry wasn't able to kill off hydro because hydro was actually a very useful way of making electricity. You could store the electricity by storing the water in the dam. You could switch it on when you wanted it. It was an attractive technology.
So there's a bit of a battery alternative then. Yeah.
Malcolm,
thanks for making my argument.
Yeah, Leonie.
That renewables haven't, wind and solar have not caught on, isn't because the fossil industry has it in for them. Because if that was the case, the fossil industry would have managed to suppress hydro. It's the fact that they are horrendously unfitted towards economies which actually value secure power supplies coming when you want it, and grids which can be managed on a moment-by-moment basis.
So managing,
and that's why, despite the massive subsidies, Siemens are losing money hand over fist in wind. And it's... it's a bit depressing when these things, which are self-evidently true, you only have to look at the way things have developed, fall back into this conspiracy theory approach rather than actually addressing the real problem there, which is physics, not institutional skullduggery.
It's not a conspiracy theory, it's economics. We're debating economic theory of monopolies.
It sounds to me there are design issues there, Graham, which you're in poor position to address. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you just put my argument. I mean, the hydropower is a very good example of how the market sorts it out. Mm. And that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Andy asked me
in other words,
how do you do it? Mm. And that's how the market does do it.
And it's also a very good demonstration. But
what the fossil industry is doing is interfering with the market forces. It's taken a monopoly.
Let's pause that there, folks.
I was just going to say, when Malcolm was running through his list of places that have done great things in terms of hydro, that he's missed out. Egypt, which has got, they actually completely destroyed ancient monuments. Well, they didn't destroy them, they moved them, which is quite the most astonishing thing. So because of the massive Aswan Dam. China, which flooded the Three Gorges and has got a lot of hydro as well. And India, which has also got a lot of hydro. So, hydro has been... And South America. So it's been used very much more widely around the world. And it does address the issue that Malcolm has often raised and relating to some renewables, which is around intermittency in a lot of places of solar and wind. Obviously, there are quite a large number of places where intermittency does not apply to solar. Because, the endless warm and sunny days, or even hot and sunny days, happen as a matter of course in countries, roughly speaking, in the tropics.
A lot of those countries still have nighttime.
They do have nighttime as well. But during the nighttime, quite a lot of people in those countries, in fact, go to sleep. So we also have intermittency of demand. So it's matching the two together. And that's what, grid balancing is all about, isn't it, Malcolm? So I just think it's adds in another dimension into balancing the grid, where you've not only got fluctuating demand, which is something that has often been talked about in the mythical, or probably not so mythical, but, half time when everyone gets up from the football to go and make a cup of tea and suddenly the grid sort of has a massive demand of everybody switching on their kettles. But intermittency of supply at the same time makes managing the grid a much more complex endeavour than it currently is at the moment, where essentially, you have base load running from power stations, some coal, some gas, some nuclear, is a lot easier to manage than having intermittent supply. And if that then becomes your baseload, then yes, I think that is quite difficult, which I suspect is why all political parties, whether they are, strongly pro-nuclear or softly pro-nuclear, are all talking about having baseload supplied by nuclear, which is, of course, doesn't produce CO2 as a byproduct of the process. It does produce other waste, of course, but I think that's a separate debate. But that was all I really wanted to say, is I think hydro has become a lot more widespread than Malcolm's shorter list of countries. That was it, really.
And apparently fusion is now working.
I think it worked for about a millisecond. So I don't think
well, you've got to start somewhere, haven't you?
I think
a minute and a half in the States with the batteries.
They've demonstrated the physics with fusion, but in a sense, in any process, the science is the easy bit. You've then got to show that you can engineer a machine that actually generates useful electricity. So there's the engineering demonstration, and then you've got to demonstrate the economics. So I think fusion. Funnily enough, the process that we had up to about 6 months ago, whereby we were getting out 95% as much energy as we put in, moving over to one where we're getting 105% as much energy out as we put in, is not actually that significant as such. It's a step on a long road. But I mean, fusion is, we know fusion works because it powers the universe. So it's a matter of can we encapsulate it?
Can we harness it effectively?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. It'd be a bit awkward to have
this. Energy, really.
Yeah, it's a bit of a challenge to say, let's move the sun a bit closer and we could use the fusion process.
Well, I'm sure Elon Musk is listening. He must be having thoughts in that direction, mustn't he?
I mean, there are some of us listening to the ever charmingly express myself Lee Anderson, who would quite wish that he would take a journey.
Oh, one of
towards,
our great public intellectuals, indeed. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's Pink Floyd, "Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun," and I'm, as far as I'm concerned, I would quite like
in Billericay. Yep.
I'd like him to be on that spaceship. He is so rude. I think he infects the public discourse with a really.
I'm
bad.
Sure he'd be deeply flattered by your tribute to him there.
Oh, I'm sure he would. I'm sure I'm sure he does it deliberately. He's like Doris, it's all about headlines, blah blah blah. Oh, so offensive. Offensive.
Do you fancy having a natter about Sheila Hancock's piece? I think again in Prospect. She's got a new book out, bless her. It's sort of, seniority grumps, well-worn but very justified thread. One of them, having decamped from France, is the nature of British hospitality. So, for example, she gets a late night cup of tea and not particularly nice toasty in Manchester, and then a student sheepishly turns up as she's gone to bed with a cart machine, assuming she's going to do a runner. when you're on the road, do you have experiences like that? And do you agree with her proposition that we British are not very good at hospitality? Russell Fawlty may be listening somewhere.
Yes and no. I mean, I've never had that experience of someone turning up with a carb machine after I've had a late night cup of tea, because most places they provide something in the room so you can boil a kettle and make your own cup of tea these days.
Well, but, health and safety, you see. Yeah. Or perhaps even the energy cost. I don't know. Yeah.
But, I don't entirely agree with that. I mean, I've been to places where it's been pretty scant. The hospitality, but I've also been to other places where, you know, people fall over themselves and are incredibly helpful, and it's been an absolute pleasure to stay there. So
I have an NBQ2 in falling over myself, actually. Yes, I'm very proud of it. Yeah.
So I'm not sure I'm entirely buying that. I mean, and I think everybody reserves the right to have a grumpy off day, don't they, as well?
Mm.
I mean, you know, you can't guarantee that the person who is dealing with you hasn't, you know, there might be something else going on for them in their life. I mean, if they're really grumpy, if they're being really, really grumpy, then I might say something and try and sort of jolly them out of it. Or I might just completely ignore it and, move on as quickly as you pay your shot and leave. But no, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I've been to places in France where they've just been absolutely horrifically rude. So
you have to be a local. Yeah, this is a local hotel for local people, as someone said, isn't it, to some extent?
Some of the French, they're very snooty. Yeah. Mm. Some Parisians won't even speak to other French people. But they certainly won't speak to you unless you speak with a Paris accent. Which is just ridiculous.
For you, that might be a bit of a tough call. You're a woman of many wonderful voices, but yeah. I have to say, I'd like my breeze through Montmartre through in lockdown, but it was a very different vibe then. It was somewhat village-like, less city, less urban in terms of its footfall. Graham, you've spent quite a lot of time in France. I mean, do you recognise that? Do you empathise with Sheila's woes about British hospitality? And it is, again, is this sort of a design problem in a sense of what the barns are like that we occupy when we're on the road?
Yeah, there's one aspect that hasn't been explored much of the consequences of Brexit.
Mm.
I mean, there is a resentment, you know, in France about Brexit, which is, you know, is increasing non-cooperation, I think. this is what the government simply didn't. Well, it wanted Boris Johnson wanted to rely on that, the people's anti-French, anti-continent, anti-European feelings.
Those damn froggies and all that stuff.
It's part of populism. So, but I think that it just adds to the whole. Is now, what is it, 63% wanting reversal of Brexit against...
There's still small voice, yeah.
Yeah, there's now fewer and fewer people still happy with voting to leave.
Mm.
So I think that's... it's going to come up in the election. It has to. Because Keir Starmer not revoking Brexit, he's showing he's not in control, and that's exactly the Brexit slogan.
Because he might say yet. Mel, harking back to Sheila there, I mean, she's a great fan of Branchline Britain and the flora and fauna at the trackside there. But do you share her woes about British hospitality when you travel around the UK? What sort of experiences do you have?
Yeah, I mean, I must say, I don't notice enormous differences when I'm staying in a UK hotel to a continental one or an American. Actually, no, the Americans do it differently. The Americans have got a real pizzazz about it. Mm. And I always think we've never really valued service in the way that certainly the French do. I mean, the French regard, you know, the waiters as it's really quite a high status job to be a waiter. And they take enormous pride in it. And I think it goes back really that there's quite interesting stuff in David Nobbs's Wretched Parent. There's a lovely line in there where Jimmy, the uncle who's an ex-army man, says he's got a theory. You know, the reason why the British are such good soldiers is that our food is so awful that in France, you know, great cuisine, so people don't like to go out and risk their lives in war. You know, Britain, stodgy stuff, and so we're all quite happy to go out and die. And it's nicely put, but there's sort of a tiny, tiny hint of truth maybe at the bottom of that. That we just don't seem to respect and value. We almost see the waiter as being invisible, I think. Is
we employ students and it's minimum wage and all that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, as opposed to being someone who is skilled and professional and does a good job and can be admired for it.
We were going to have cafe society under the Blair government, weren't we? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, if you look in Wandsworth, you know, there are areas like the North Coast.
We've met in one or two of them, haven't we? Yeah.
But cafe culture did make some inroad to that sort of time. Northcote Road has a kind of slight feel of Paris about it sometimes, with the sitting out on the pavements,
even in the rain. Yes, yeah.
The cafe Rouge
really totally caught up.
Yeah, that was gone now, isn't it? But that was very popular. Yeah,
Cafe Rouge.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's someone on the Dole who started it, wasn't it?
I believe so. Yes, I mean, no doubt there'll be new flourishings of it, but it's so often where people start, isn't it? In catering, I mean, I myself was a kitchen porter at the Savoy for some years, and somehow it didn't get demolished in the process. But that was before health and safety was invented. I remember scenes of carnage.
Of course, the biggest thing in Paris that no one ever talks about are the rats, which are which are enormous. The only place I've ever seen rats the same size as Parisian rats is I had the opportunity to go on a visit to Wandsworth Prison, and I have to tell you, the rats were the size of cats in there. My God, they're huge. Absolutely vast.
They're on scotch, presumably. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I don't know what...
Embankment Gardens by Temple Station. I mean, that's...
Mm.
Overrun by rats.
Mm.
You see them running around all over the place.
It's a thought, well, isn't it? Yes, and presumably none of them will stand for the constituency of North Bedfordshire, at least in the immediate future.
Well, I don't believe there's a vacancy. That rat has not left the sinking
ship,
despite her comments saying that she would. I think she's made herself a complete laughing stock. I mean, even Conservatives are now
doing anything apart from, you know, asking for bits of.
We kind of forget that the Tories have already suspended her once because she went off onto I'm a Celebrity. And I'm surprised they haven't taken the same action again now. It's just a complete disgrace for these.
Well, it's wildly popular, presumably, in somewhere. Yeah.
To be completely unrepresented for so long. It's not what, you know, people ought to be. And to be fair, I think most members of Parliament do recognise that it's a privilege and work hard for their constituents. And it kind of draws the whole political establishment into disrepute when someone like this gets away with it for so long, drawing this sort of, really still very substantial parliamentary salary compared to what most people earn in the country, for literally, it seems, doing nothing or next to nothing.
Mm. Well, I grew up in Poole. I think Oscar Merton had you might remember this well, had the reputation for saying the least in the House over about something like a 40-year career. But he did show up in his constituency, I suppose that was the thing.
Yes, I mean, the old Knights of the Shires and the stereotype, which was not without foundation, they were still known locally. The likes of Gerald Nabarro comes into mind,
who was
a very famous, massive, great moustache member of Parliament in Worcestershire, who was actually from quite a modest background himself, but who almost became the sort of poster boy for that type of MP, but was very well known in his area of, was it Worcester City or one of the areas?
I think he wound up in Thurrock at the end. I'm not sure if he was on the stump there or whether he was actually a candidate, but yeah.
But interesting, and those, Sir Bufton Tufton, as he became in private life. But nonetheless, they were characters in their community and were known to be community-minded and to work for their constituents, and as I say, most MPs do. I think we're very unkind to our MPs and politicians generally, who, as a group, I think are very public-minded. But it doesn't take terribly many of them to let the whole side down, unfortunately. I don't know whether that sort of segues into by-elections, but it's been a cracking couple of weeks for the Liberal Democrats. One has to say. Last week they took a seat in Norfolk, North Norfolk, on a 35% swing from the Tories. They came from nowhere. They hadn't even put a candidate up last election, and the Tories got 2/3 of the vote last time round. Lib Dems came to take that. I mean, that is really serious concern for Tories if that level of dyed-in-the-wool conservatism is going over. They also took a seat in East Sussex, which was important because it means East Sussex County Council is now in no overall control. Again, a pretty extraordinary thought of what you'd think of. The county councils have always been the last bastion of conservatism when things are going wrong. And to be in a position they no longer control East Sussex Council is quite extraordinary. Lib Dems also took a seat from Labour in Dudley in the West Midlands, and they've not had a seat on Dudley Council since 2007. And that will cause some sort of questions about an area which is, West Midlands classically one of the areas, along with the North, that Labour has to win back and win back big. And then last night, Castle Carey, which is a Somerset Council seat, which
Somerset.
Is split between the Yeovil and the Somerton and Frome constituencies. But that was, it had, when Somerset became a unitary authority last year, the way they did it quite cleverly was that the county council, which had been made up largely of one-member wards, simply doubled the number of councillors there to make up for the fact that they lost all the district councillors. And so in last year's election, it was one Conservative, one Lib Dem, a couple who had been nip and tuck with each other for many years and kind of swapped the previous seat. And they both won it. But then the Conservative passed away, sadly. But the Lib Dems just walked it, as might be expected. So it does look, at least in local government, as if the Lib Dems are really coming back into business in a serious way now. Whether that will reflect in what that will do in the blue wall seats where they are Lib Dem versus Conservative not even marginals, but where the Lib Dems are the main challengers to the Conservatives. It'll be interesting to see next year how that reflects in the general elections. But I think out of the major parties at the moment, it's probably the Lib Dems who are feeling most comfortable.
Mm. Do you think, Graham, the pro-Brexit, the anti-Brexit aspect of Lib Demery, at least in the sort of soft element of its policy making and thinking on the stump, is an element in this, and do you see the tide turning?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it looks as if Lib Dem made the call for revoke too early, when the people hadn't experienced how bad Brexit was. But now I don't think there's anyone in the country who hasn't experienced how bad it is. So everyone's suffering from it. And it's the extraordinary thing is that the legal solution is what's being censored at the moment by all the parties. You know, they simply won't inform the public that it's simply a legal question of revoking Brexit. It's not a question of re-holding the referendum.
Mm.
Which is the only thing that's holding up going back into Europe.
Yeah. Leonie, do you welcome give credibility to a Lib Dem resurgence? What would it do to our political landscape?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the results in 2001 and 2005, when the Liberal Democrats ended up in Parliament with 62 MPs under Charles Kennedy, who was a leader with principles, as opposed to Nick Clegg, who was completely unprincipled and destroyed the Liberal Democrat Party by joining the Conservative government in 2010, so that by 2015 there were almost no Liberal Democrats in Parliament. And I think it's taken, if we assume the general election is going to be 2024, at the latest 2025, it's taken the Liberal Democrats that 10-year period to rebuild. I don't think people are voting on favour of the Liberal Democrats because of their views on Brexit one way or the other. I think people are voting for the party that they think is going to be the best way to boot out the Conservatives, because people are just fed up with this undead zombie government that everybody assumes is going to lose big time, and I think it will. And of course, it helps Labour to form a majority, or at least to be very much the largest party, if the Liberal Democrats take a load of seats off the Conservatives. I think the really interesting by-election is going to be Rutherglen and Hamilton in Scotland, and to see if Labour can take that seat off the Conservatives with a convincing...
the Scottish Nationalists.
Not the Conservatives, the Scottish Nationalists, which, you know, you would hope that they would be able to, or somebody should be able to take it, because that woman has behaved quite disgracefully. And the party that she, and also I think the Scot Nats are in a pretty bad place with various of their previous leadership and party the leadership
being out of
all being arrested and whatnot. So I think, you know, that will help us read the runes. And if Nadine Dorries ever goes away, then hopefully she'll be replaced. I think the Liberal Democrats could be on the up again. They used to have a lot of seats in the southwest. They used to have seats like Winchester and Eastleigh and Eastbourne. You know, who knows? They might be able to win some of these parliamentary seats back. And looking at Woking Council, if I was the Conservative MP for Woking, I wouldn't be too happy at looking at the number of Conservatives who've lost their seats there. It's possible that the Liberal Democrats could be making breakthroughs in a few new places like that. I don't know whether they've quite got the activists to do that, though. They're a much smaller party than the Conservatives or Labour. But we'll have to see. Maybe they can. They're certainly usually very good at targeting where they think they're most likely to break through. And I don't know whether new seats like Woking would get onto that list. But, yeah, I think they're in with a real chance.
Just for the west of West London. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Have a great weekend.
Likewise.
Thanks.
Thank you.